So
With the
I've got
rails
a
from the
Welcome. We're getting ready to convene a joint committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee of General Government. Today is May 16, 2017, and today we will be having a public hearing on SB 5541, Treasurer of the State. And before we begin, LFO, if there's something.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, before you is the Treasurer of the State. They have a robust presentation for the next 2 days. And upon completion of the treasurer's phase two items, the general government subcommittee will have gone through all the agencies for phase one and phase two. And so it'll be a milestone for the subcommittee. But the treasurer's presentation materials are on OLIS, and they've done a fine job in putting them together. So thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. And with that, we have the treasurer, Mr. Tobias Reed, and I don't know if you're going to be joined by your deputy.
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Treasurer, Deputy Treasurer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And please, before you get started, which I always do, I always forget to state my name and who I am. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed. I'm happy to be State Treasurer. I'm joined by our Deputy Treasurer, Darren Bond. And our intent, as your staff ably summarized, is to give you a bit more detail. You'll remember that we were before you in phase one some weeks ago. So our agenda, as I said, is to kind of give you a refresh on some of the areas that that we work and go over the policy option packages following the outline here along with your intent. And you can follow along the top. It's useful for me in the longer presentations. So the State Treasury, of course, is a big effort that does a lot of different things. Our vision and mission, I hope, are familiar, as is the scope of what we do, with a large portfolio serving as the state's financial management and banking services provider. We do a lot of different things. Our priorities are also in line with these themes, seeking to do business the right way, to empower Oregonians to save for themselves, and to continue the modernization of our various programs and services. The budget is perhaps a little different than some of the others that you examine, in that the vast majority of our funds come from other sources, so they are not competing with education and the other things that you consider in the legislature. The exception to that, you'll notice in the darker blue, is two general fund loan requests to support Oregon Saves and the Oregon ABLE program, and we'll say more about that later on. You can see on the right where those dollars are directed. Another view of that here is the difference between the expenditures and what's included in the policy option packages. We'll have more to say about that, obviously, as we go forward. The organizational chart is presented here so that you can kind of see where these various programs sit. And one way to think about those is the programs that serve Oregon governments, and as distinct from how we serve Oregon families. We'll return to this theme as we go through the various divisions. And with that, I'll let our Deputy Treasurer talk briefly about the revenue sources.
Thanks, Mr. Treasurer, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Darren Bond. I'm the Deputy State Treasurer. So these are Treasury's revenue sources for our government, primarily government-facing programs. I will speak to the family-facing programs later today or tomorrow. These programs, our revenue sources, are administrative fees, transaction fees, basically, and in one instance, a small expense reimbursement program. If we look specifically at the investment division, we have two primary sources of revenue, both administrative fees with somewhat different fee structure, and our commingled funds, the primary of which is the Oregon Short-Term Fund. We may deduct up to 0.435 basis points from that. a basis point being 1/100th of a percentage point. For the for this other discrete programs that we manage, like PERS, SAFE, the Common School Fund, we can charge up to 0.25 basis points per month. Our cash management program is primarily funded from banking service charges in the Oregon Short-Term Fund, again, with the investments, having the investment side of the house and the finance division having the administrative side of the house. So again, that same 0.435 basis points, coupled with service charges for the specific kinds of banking transactions that agencies and local governments use. And we have a price list that's published that has those specific charges for prices for checks, ACH deposits, et cetera. Our collateral pool program is where we protect public funds by ensuring that financial institutions that accept public deposits are collateralizing those programs. The credit unions and banks that participate in that program reimburse us on a quarterly basis for the costs that were incurred for the prior quarter, and that's distribution is made on a pro rata basis depending on the size of the deposit volume that they have of total public funds deposits. Our debt management program is a combination of processing fees and issuance fees for the debt issuance that we do, the coordination we do with local governments, the bond calendar, the monitoring legislation through MDAC and things like that.
Mr. Bond, for the sake of people that are not unfamiliar with some of the acronyms, could you kind of spell those out for me?
Sure. MDAC is the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. Actually, it says committee there. Our mistake. OFA is the Oregon Facilities Authority. So that's the program within which we assist nonprofits in the state accessing the financial markets. So it's their debt. There's no state liability involved with it, but we have the mechanisms to help them be able to better access the markets. Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, MDAC, is a program within which we assist local governments in issuing their debt and helping them stage bringing their debt to market. We provide a bond calendar. We provide reports, primary of which is the overlapping debt report, where they can come to us and look and see what the total burden on their municipality is, given whatever debt might be in school districts, the county, water districts, et cetera. We can layer all that on and give them a total picture of the debt burden in their district.
Thank you.
And that is pretty much our revenue picture. And now we'll turn to our POPs.
So these are the policy option packages, and this is kind of a preview of what we will be going through in more detail, but you can see the large picture here. And I'll move to the Investment Management Division, joined by our CIO. This is probably the task and the group that we're best known for in the State Treasury, and for obvious reasons, because it is significant and important. What I think you should know or remember as you listen to John Shervin is the large size of the portfolio that the Investment Management Division manages and the lean staffing. And he'll have something to say about that. But despite those challenges, this group is consistently ranked at the very top of our peer group, has, I think, a really good combination of a strategy that tries to capitalize on our competitive advantage in private markets and our cost savings in public markets. Mr. Shervin has been here for a number of years now, and we're lucky to have him as well as a whole bunch of other talent in our Investment Management Division. So we're happy that he's here to talk about that. Mr. Shervin.
Thank you, Treasurer Reed, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Shervin, Chief Investment Officer and Investment Division Director. I'm here to talk about POP 101 and share with you the details. I'll start by saying that the objective for POP 101 in my mind is really to fortify and extend the competitive advantages that the Oregon Investment Program enjoys, and they are significant. I'd also describe those competitive advantages. One of them I'd describe as natural, and the other I would describe as earned. And I'm going to talk about those competitive advantages in more detail. But those are our objectives, is to press our competitive advantages in the capital markets, the global capital markets in which we compete. Let's start. Did I do that wrong? What am I?
Keep going.
There we go. Okay. Let's start with what I consider the governance slide. You see there in the upper left-hand corner, the Oregon Investment Council, which by statute has supreme fiduciary responsibility for all the states, for the investment of all the states' assets. And then you have the treasurer, who is the state's designated investment officer. And then you have Darren and I and the investment staff who make things happen on a day-to-day basis. The investment program today is $94 billion in assets. The majority of that, of course, is in the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund. And then another 17%, roughly $16 billion, is in the Oregon Short-Term Fund. For context, our defined benefit plan, OPERF, is the 21st largest defined benefit plan in the United States among public plans. So that would put us in what's called the mid-size category. But for some additional context, I would make the argument that OPERF is disproportionately impactful to our state, good or bad. It's mid-size in absolute terms, but in a state with 4 million people, a $94 billion program is pretty impactful. So CalPERS, the investment program in California, is the country's largest public fund. It's over $300 billion. So it's a little over three times the size of our program, but California's population is 10 times the size of Oregon. So when you scale it that way, you can see that OPERF and the program in particular really is quite impactful for our state.
Let me ask you a question about that. Who qualifies for that program? That retirement OPEC, who qualifies for that? You know, we talk about, I don't know. I know that PERS has been really highlighted, and now I'm looking at this one, OPEC.
It's the same, Mr. Chair. The Public Employee Retirement Fund are the dollars that support PERS, the Public Employee Retirement System.
So this is the same program.
Well, there are ostensibly, and Mr. Borden is an expert on this, but there are ostensibly three different. There's the Tier 1, Tier 2, and then what is functionally Tier 3. And Mr. Borden can hold forth with much more expertise than I.
No, I guess you're it then. So we.
Oh, you got him.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. Go ahead. I was just trying to wrap my, I'm seeing different things and how they are connected.
At the highest level, Chair, Co-Chair Banning, we're talking about the assets that go to support the liabilities.
Okay. Now I'm there.
We're the asset side of the ledger.
Okay, and now I'm there.
My colleague would be Steve Rodeman, who would be the liability side of the ledger.
And, Mr. Chair, confusing this is the fact that in legislative speak, we call these all sorts of different things. And so same program, different name, depending on who you ask and what the context of the conversation is. But these guys count the money.
Okay, I'm there. Thank you.
So now I'd like to talk a little bit more about how we do what we do. And I think an important understanding would be that we invest state assets across three primary dimensions. So the primary dimensions I'd want you to focus on, first and foremost, would be the asset type, the types of assets that we invest. The next level or the next dimension would be the level of complexity in the asset or in the strategy that we're investing that asset. So type, complexity, and then the third would be domicile. Where is the asset managed? Is it managed internally by Treasury staff, or is it managed externally by a manager we've hired? This slide really gets at the first two dimensions. This slide gets at asset type, and it gets at asset complexity. So we'll start with asset type. The broad categories that we invest in are listed across the top: stocks, fixed income, private equity, real estate, and alternatives. Fixed income is a fancy word for bonds. alternatives is kind of a catch-all for the eclectic private market strategies that we pursue. But those are the big five categories that we invest in. So that's asset type. This slide also helps us with complexity. If you would please draw an imaginary line, draw an imaginary vertical line between the fixed income category and the private equity category, we will then have effectively segregated the portfolio on the dimension of complexity. So again, an imaginary vertical line between fixed income and private equity. Anything to the left, stocks and bonds, relatively straightforward. These comprise 60% of the program. Stocks and bonds are highly liquid, transparent, relatively straightforward investment strategies that comprise 60% of our portfolio. I will introduce an ice cream analogy and describe them as the chocolate and vanilla part of the portfolio. Everything to the right has a degree and sometimes a high degree of complexity. These are strategies that are often illiquid. They are often opaque, complicated. They comprise now about 40% of our program. These are the other 29 flavors. So simple and straightforward on the left, complex and often opaque on the right.
Senator has a question.
Would either of you two gentlemen comment on the impact of the legislature calling in investment plays, for lack of a better word, when we as 90 lay people are giving you as professional money managers or by extension the folks that you contract with, when we're giving you direction on types or quantities of investment holdings, regardless of what they are in your ice cream analogy, could you comment a little bit on the impact of that?
I'm happy to take it. Co-Chair Manning's committee members and Senator Johnson in particular, I would consider that most likely very well intended and most likely not entirely well informed. One of the benefits of being part of the Oregon Investment Program, the $94 billion program, is we have a terrific brand. We have a terrific institutional investment brand. It dates back to 1979 in particular, and some of the innovation that then OIC Chair Roger Meyer introduced. It's a long and really proud story, but the cumulative effect of that innovation that has been carried on in succeeding generations of treasurers and OIC members is we have one of the most powerful institutional investment brands, not in the country, in the world. We get invited to transactions that many of our larger peers do not. The importance of that brand is we get a look at everything. We have an open door policy, so we have hundreds of meetings a year. And so I guess the punchline, Senator Johnson, it would be highly unlikely for a layperson to be in a network that was better than ours.
The only thing I'd add, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, is that we take our responsibility to generate returns for the state very seriously. And I would underscore the open door policy. We're eager to talk with anyone, including legislators, about what we do and why we do it. And I think that leads us to have a better chance of maximizing our returns.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
So last thing I want to say on this slide is, again, we've got this segregation. We've got the asset types on the top, and then on the left-hand side of our imaginary line, we've got the transparent, publicly traded, straightforward strategies. On the right-hand side, we have the more complex and opaque private market strategies. The left-hand side of the ledger comports with our natural competitive advantage, and the right-hand side comports with our earned competitive advantage. And I'm going to elaborate on that in more detail. But left side, natural advantage, right side, earned advantage. The third dimension, so we've covered two dimensions. We've covered asset type. We've covered asset complexity. The third dimension on how we invest is domicile. Where do we manage the money? Do we manage it internally, or do we delegate it to external managers? This slide gives you the answer. Currently, $24 billion, or approximately 25% of our program, is internally managed. The other $70 billion, or three-quarters of the program, is delegated to external managers. And the obvious question would be, why do we care? Why do we care about domicile? And the answer is cost. We can manage assets internally for a fraction of what it costs to delegate to external managers. This is our natural advantage. We're located in Tigard, Oregon. It's a low-cost manufacturing site relative to world financial centers like New York City, London, Sydney, Hong Kong. So our natural advantage in the institutional investment world is, to the extent we can manage assets internally, we can do so at an extremely competitive rate relative to the external alternatives. So again, that's a pretty big differential. These are average, averaged across the asset types. Some assets are chocolate and vanilla. Others are more exotic flavors and therefore more expensive. But on average, our internal costs are a fraction, 5 basis points, relative to, on average, 70 basis points to delegate to external managers.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Then could one draw the conclusion that, given your strength and some of the attributes of your program, could one not draw the conclusion that to have you manage more internally made sense fiscally, and that you had the capacity and the capability of doing that?
Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, you've read ahead in the slides, because we have the capability, but we don't yet have sufficient capacity. So I have the talent, I have the skill, I have some of the infrastructure. I don't have all the ingredients we need to expand the magnitude of internal asset management that we'd like to. So we have not yet fully capitalized on our natural advantage, our natural competitive advantage of being a low-cost manufacturer in Tigard, Oregon. We have not taken full advantage of that.
As I listen to you contrast your location in beautiful downtown Tigard with Singapore, London, New York, I kept thinking the food isn't as good in Tigard.
There's trade-offs in everything.
Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk a little bit about the types of investments that are managed externally versus internally, and the types of things that you might have capacity to shift? Because I'm assuming every type of investment on that previous page you might not be able to take on.
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Fahey, members of the committee, it's an outstanding question, because the logical conclusion from my remarks so far would be, give Shervam everything he needs and let's manage it all internally. And while that would be logical, it would be incorrect, because there's some flavors that are too exotic and the recipes are too complicated and the ingredients are too expensive for us to make in Tigard, Oregon. And so there is a limit to what we would want to, and frankly, what we could responsibly manage in Tigard. And so the short answer is, we've got capacity, we've got the capability, and we're asking for sufficient capacity to do more chocolate and vanilla. Again, 60% of our program is the simpler, transparent stuff. Whereas the other 40%, the private market strategies that are a little illiquid, opaque, they have very high requisite skill quotients, that's not something we could or should responsibly to try to take on from Tigard.
I have a couple follow-ups. So what proportion of that $65 billion that's external is chocolate and vanilla versus more exotic flavors?
So again, that's the right line to go down. I don't know the exact number, but so think about it in the broadest terms. 60% of the program is chocolate and vanilla, and you have almost an identical amount that's outsource. So we have plenty of room to insource chocolate and vanilla mandates.
Okay. One last follow-up. So, you know, if the entirety, this is not true, but if the entirety of that amount in the external category was the complex, more exotic flavors, I wouldn't necessarily be so surprised to see a big difference in the number of basis points that the cost of investing. So it's trying to get a sense of, I appreciate that we're very effective in managing internally on a cost-effective basis, but it's a little, depending on the type of investments, it's a little bit of apples and oranges to compare those numbers.
Oh, it absolutely is. That 70 basis points is an average of some very complex strategies that are very expensive, but it also, that 70 basis
return,
points
presumably.
Also that 70 basis points also includes some externally managed chocolate and vanilla.
Yeah.
That is being done at 50 basis points or 40 that we could do for 5.
I'm willing to, you know, I might be willing to pay 70 basis points if I get a 30% return.
Right.
On an exotic investment.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Fahey, that's exactly right. There are some things we want to pay for and some that we don't need to pay for. So I think you're both on the same page.
Okay.
Yeah. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. Same topic, slightly different perspective. How did we get to the $29 billion that we are managing ourselves now? Does that reflect just our internal capacity? Is that a particular chunk of the overall investments?
Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Representative Marsh. The short answer is, when I joined almost 5 years ago, we had a fairly substantive internal management program. The Oregon Short-Term Fund in and of itself is entirely internally managed and in many ways represents the jewel of the program because there is no commercial alternative to the Oregon Short-Term Fund that it comes even close. Right now that fund for overnight dollar NAV is printing 130 basis points. That's more than double the closest commercial alternative. It's extraordinary. We were also running about $4 billion in long-only, plain vanilla, middle-of-the-fairway public equities. However, I did consult with Deputy Treasurer Bond and then Treasurer Wheeler and say, we have the talent. We have the capability to do more. We do not have the systems, and we do not have the middle and back office processes and people to do more. We were at our limit, in my opinion. Okay. So we're talking about trying to further capitalize on this competitive advantage that we have in Tigard, Oregon. But As the representative's question just illuminated, it is my professional opinion that even though we've made some very important strides in the last couple of years, we're still constrained. And the evidence of those constraints would be this chart showing us versus our global peers, same size AUM, assets under management, same asset complexity. This is even after last session's increase to our expenditure limitation. So this is even after the assimilation of round numbers, 10 new FTEs. You know, last session was extraordinary in that with our POP last session, we went from, again, round numbers, 20 FTE to 30 FTE. I'm not that great at math, but I think that's a 50% increase. And that's that was transformative. It is transformative. But even still, even after that, we're at or near the bottom of our peer group on every dimension. And so we still have these constraints in terms of our ability to capitalize on our natural competitive advantage. This is the org chart of the investment program before last session's POP. So this is prior to that increase in our expenditure limitation. And just in terms of nomenclature, on the left-hand side, investors, that really should be investment officers. That should be investment officers. And in terms of our jargon, those that I would refer to those folks as the front end. Those are the highly skilled investment officers. So this is what we looked like before last session. Then in August of 2014, the Oregon Investment Council approved a contract with BlackRock to acquire the Aladdin system. That implementation started in March of 15, was successfully activated in September on time, on budget. And then we got a very meaningful expenditure limitation increase last session that enabled us to add the first, what I'll call the first complement of middle and back office staff. So we got Aladdin, state-of-the-art digital infrastructure, and we got the first complement of people to run it. We moved $4 billion of long-only public equities onto it. We moved the Oregon short-term fund onto it. We moved a couple of other plain vanilla fixed income strategies onto it. So we've now got a year under our belt using Aladdin, and with our first complement of middle and back office personnel. The other thing that last session's resources gave us was some leverage in the front office. So we didn't increase the number of investment officers, the higher priced investment talent, but we did add some analysts and support people. And that really helped us a lot in terms of our operating leverage in the front office.
Senator Johnson.
I'm going to ask Treasurer Reed to drop back in his old life and be Representative Reed for a few minutes. You recall that Senator Whitsitt was very concerned about Treasury's ability to manage some county funds, and it was taking a long time for that to ramp up. Has that happened?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it has. One of the last slides that Mr. Sherman will talk about includes that intermediate fund that I think Senator and Representative Whitsitt were interested in.
I couldn't remember the name of it. And is it producing for the counties and municipalities the benefit that they believed was going to accrue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I'll let Mr. Sherman certainly answer, but I would say it's early to come to conclusions on that. So I think it remains to be seen. There has not been, I would say, a lot of robust interest in that, but it is there, and if local governments want to participate, it's available to them.
Cool. Thank you.
So this is now what we're asking for in POP 101 in this session, is to build out the second wave in our middle and back office. That, again, we have the capability. This second wave in the middle and back office will be give us the capacity to do more in internal management. Again, we've got the infrastructure with Aladdin. We've got a year under our belt operating it. Now we need some more bodies, and we can scale it. We can increase the scale of our internal management activities, and as you saw in the previous couple of slides, we can do so at a very significant cost advantage. But the other thing we're asking for this year, which is different from last session, is we're asking for some more bodies in the front office. So back to our two competitive advantages. One is natural. That's the low-cost manufacturing site in Tigard. The other is earned, that 38-year reputation as an innovative public fund investor.
Senator Johnson.
I didn't think you were going to call me that fast, and I just completely lost. Oh, it's back now. Given that the Treasury has a special place in our constitutional construct, to what degree are you able to manage your own cybersecurity, your own IT? Has there been any push to try to stuff you into my old friend, the data center?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, there has, and if you will indulge us, we have that as a specific topic. Following Mr. Sherman, we'll have our new Chief Information Officer before you, and we can take that up then, if that's all right with you.
That would be just dandy.
Thank you.
So again, this slide summarizes really the essence of POP 101, which is the second complement of middle and back office resources that we need to expand the magnitude of our internal management capabilities and therefore save even more money for the funds, but also press our competitive advantage in private markets. We need more boots in the ground because private markets now comprise 40% of our program.
Representative Marsh.
I am interested. Almost every department that has come to us has talked about the difficulty of recruiting folks to take the place of empty seats, especially when we have so many people retiring throughout our system. In this POP, you're asking for the capability to hire some pretty skilled people. How do we compete in the private market for those people?
Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Representative Marsh, recruiting is one of the least of my worries. As I mentioned earlier, we have one of the most powerful investment brands in the world. Oregon is a wonderful place to live. We get lots of people that want to work for us. Lots of highly qualified people. So the most difficult part we have in recruiting is sorting through the literally dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of resumes that we get.
Okay. Great.
Last thing I want to mention on this slide is our POP also includes, and I think the Treasurer is going to talk about this later, the formalization of some of our governance and sustainability efforts. We want to advance those efforts with a dedicated ESG officer, and importantly, that role would be in the front office. And this gets to the returns. In the upper right-hand corner, the 10-year annualized return for OPERF is number one among its peer group. And so that is something that we're all obviously very proud of, but at the same time very cognizant of the fact that it takes a terrific amount of effort and support from the legislature to maintain that superlative ranking. And part of it comes in the form of pressing our competitive advantages in private markets. Therefore, we need more boots in the ground. And part of it comes from the cost side, which is why we're asking for the ability to expand our internal management capabilities. And then lastly, Senator Johnson, you mentioned about the the intermediate, we call it the intermediate fund. It's got a much longer acronym you can see there, but it doesn't even have a year under its belt. I can tell you, though, that year to date, that fund is up 93 basis points.
And so here's the summary.
Mr. Treasurer, you said there wasn't much interest on the part of the counties. Has it been, for lack of a better word, marketed to the counties as an opportunity? Are they, or municipalities, are they aware of it? Its existence.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I believe so. We can certainly get more specifics about those efforts. I'm afraid I would be speculating if I went much beyond that, but I think we have been in communication, as evidenced by some participation. I don't think we're certainly not hiding its existence. There are obviously different needs that different local governments have, and it's relatively new. So we may see that change over time. We can certainly get you some more information on how I've communicated about it.
You know from your old legislative days that AOC and LOC have conventions, the annual meetings, and they frequently have, Mr. Bond is going, we know we do that. We don't need you to tell us. Thank you. So.
We have participated, I'm told.
Thank
so.
You.
Thank you, Senator. So this is the summary of POP 101. Mr. Sherman's done a good job of illuminating the very robust team and strategy that's behind all of it. There are, as always, ongoing conversations and technical adjustments with your staff, and we appreciate this summary from Mr. Sherman. If there aren't any other questions for Mr. Sherman, we'll move on to the previously previewed cybersecurity topic.
Mr. Treasurer, before we get in, let me Representative Fahey, and then I'll come back to Representative Nearman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm curious, if we get to the end of 2019, we've appropriately invested in POP 101, and the org chart looks like it does on page 22. What does the chart on page 17 look like? That's probably a hard question for you to pull numbers out of on an impromptu basis. But, the heart of my question is, how much can we shift from external to internal? And what does that do to the cost on either side of the equation?
Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Representative Fahey, I would be speculating, but it is speculative to look out that far, but I would say, I mean, we have a minimum of $5 billion already teed up that we know can come across as soon as we have the resources. So that would be well before 2019. And it would be my expectation that by 2019, we probably find another $5 billion. And so maybe we could do it another way. And again, this is somewhat speculative, but it'll be in the ballpark. So the program's $94 billion. What if we said that by the end of 2019, we did additional 10%? That's $9.4 billion. The savings on that, on the averages, would be 70 basis points minus 5 basis points is 65 on $9.4 billion. I did the math before I came in here. That's $61 million a year. That would overstate the savings because that's the average. And as we discussed earlier, the average is deceiving because it obfuscates the fact that pulling the average up is a bunch of private market strategies that we would never contemplate. So I think a fair number is less than half that.
And I just a quick follow-up on that, I think the thing that I'm trying to wrap my head around is if we did compare that $5 billion that you have ready to go in the external category to shift over, what is the difference in cost between the internal programs that you're managing now or the internal types of investments you're managing now and that $5 million? Because it's not 70 basis points.
No, it's not. So that's why I say, round numbers, it's probably something going from 25 to 5. So it's probably an incremental savings of 20 basis points.
Okay.
But again, 20 basis points on $5 billion is real money.
Real money.
And yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Fahey, one thing to remember in this discussion is that the Treasury is absorbing those costs if we're allowed to do so, and the system as a whole is enjoying the savings.
Right.
So there is a bit of a mismatch in that respect.
Representative Ehrman.
Good, thanks. So that teed up my question really well. So I was going to ask, what happens to the savings that you get? Do those get returned to the investors, whoever that is, somewhere in the state?
True, Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman. In this case, the vast majority of those are the beneficiaries. So that has an impact on our status and the returns that are enjoyed within the PERS system.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, if I might address Senator Johnson's question as she leaves the room. relative to the local government investment fund, we have two participants in the state participants of the local government investment fund, intermediate term fund, about $9 million of investment. We seeded it with about $200 million. So the biggest, and we have been to all of the local government finance officer gatherings to let them know that it's available. What we find is that most of the governing bodies associated with municipalities in Oregon don't want to invest because we make them explicitly acknowledge that they can lose money in this investment. And so while the Oregon Short-Term Fund is a dollar in, dollar out kind of investment, this is a real this is an investment and there is an opportunity that they can lose money in it. And the governing bodies, boards, commissions around the state have so far seemed quite unwilling to put their money to work in that way.
Thank you. So we'll move on, if there aren't any other questions on POP 101, to talk about cybersecurity. And I'm happy to welcome Chris Mullen, our Chief Information Officer. He's new to the Treasury team, but a veteran both figuratively and literally of this work, having worked for 22 years at the Department of Defense, including 8 years active duty in the Air Force in Intelligence Command and Control Systems. He is also brings with him 5 years of experience in a similar role in the Secretary of State's office. This question is obviously pretty timely given what we've been seeing around the world over the last several days, so I'm glad that Chris is going to describe some of our work, and we're glad he's part of our team.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Manning, members of the committee. My name is Chris Mullen. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon State Treasury, also known as the Director of IT. I've been in the position now for 4 weeks, so I hope you'll bear with me if there are specific clarifying questions that I might have to take back to the team and get back to you as quickly as possible.
Okay, before you get started, I do have a question. You say you're with the Secretary of State's office.
Did I?
He was previously 5 years with the Secretary of State's office, and joined us just recently, Mr. Chair.
Okay, not from the Secretary of State's office.
He was previously part of the Oregon Secretary of State's office and then just recently joined the Treasury team.
Okay. I'll get with you offline. That's interesting to see this movement like that. We'll talk later offline. Okay.
I would like to add that having been here for 4 weeks, I've been amazed by the level of security, the level of awareness within Treasury. It rivals anything I saw in my 20 years with the Department of Defense. I'm really honored to be here representing the team. Our information technology and security team is the central engine that drives many of our agency's initiatives. We provide systems integration, infrastructure, service desk, application development, and cybersecurity expertise across the agency to help our business units successfully achieve their mission, vision, and goals. We currently structure ourselves under three primary functional areas: technical services, which covers infrastructure, network management, help desk, banking operations; application services, which includes our COTS integration, in-house application builds and customization, and database management and administration. And of course, as I mentioned, our security team, which provides threat, vulnerability, and risk management, awareness policy, and incident response. This chart speaks for itself, but it really captures the industries targeted by hackers today. According to Verizon's research this year, 24% of breaches affected financial organizations, 15 healthcare organizations, and 12% were public sector entities. In essence, Treasury is a prime target, as it's both financial and public, as we're the sole provider of banking, investment, and bonding services to the state. As such, there's a level of awareness and a sense of urgency across this agency because of statistics like these, and as a result, security has become cemented in our culture, our methodologies, and our solutions. But whilst our security team has certainly done amazing work in fortifying our systems and network, cybersecurity is never done. We need to continue to provide the resources and tools for our security team to stay ahead of the threat. This slide illustrates the org chart from a functional areas perspective and breaks out the security team staffing as part of our requested positions. We have a dedicated information security team led by a chief information security officer to ensure that our cybersecurity safeguards meet or exceed industry standards. Treasury has worked with the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology co-chair, Senator Riley, on collaboration opportunities, as well as working with other state agencies. We also collaborate within the state's security community, collaborating with the State Enterprise Security Office via ad hoc issues or lessons learned, and within various groups and councils. And this is going back to the question that Senator Johnson had asked, is yes, we have had a couple of bills, as well as working with Senator Riley around the centralization of security. And there were questions asked throughout session about whether or not we should be part of that. And in the simplest terms, there are issues around us being a part of that because of the need to know and the level of skills and the specific data that relates to providing IT services with a financial entity like this. This is our security activities roadmap, which illustrates the team's effort to date and continued plans into the near term. From the initiation of a formalized program and assignment of the CISO in 2014, through various security initiatives, this graph captures the milestones of strengthening Treasury's security posture. As you can see throughout these milestones, our security program is actually built around regular recurring third-party independent assessments. But cybersecurity doesn't go into sustainment and maintenance mode. It requires continued vigilance with an eye on emerging technologies in an effort to stay ahead of the threats. This is a list of our security team's planned activities for the 17-19 biennium. We have some policy maturation work to do, continued and additional assessments and testing, perimeter security advancement, and the expansion of our data loss prevention and data encryption programs.
And I'll take the summary here, but before I do, I just want to mention, at the risk of repeating ourselves, Senator Johnson, since you were gone briefly, this is Chris Mullen, our Chief Information Officer, and he addressed to some degree your question about centralization. I'm probably not doing it justice in the eloquent way he put it, but essentially we have specific and differentiated information. We've been coordinating and collaborating with Chair Riley and the security community, but generally we're not a fan of that centralization question. This summary here is worth noting that it includes the two positions that Chris talked about, but also some significant technological solutions and external engagements. That's the reason for the relatively large number in comparison to the number of positions.
I apologize. I had visiting teachers that I just needed to speak to.
No problem.
When you say you're not a fan, I get that. Neither am I. But to what degree is there pressure to join the club? And you know how I feel about the State Data Project from the many conversations we had about it when you served in this body. Mm-hmm. And given what happened worldwide within the last couple of days, it just drives home the point that I think we have to maintain vigilance. And with your data, the specialized data you have and the specialized data PERS has, and I think the demonstrated recognition of the need for exactly the kinds of things that you just put up on your work product for the next year, I want to make sure that not a fan of it does not translate into forced into submission, absorbed by the Borg. Resistance is futile. I want to make sure you are protected from that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson, I simply didn't want to take words out of or put words in our Chief Information
Allow
Officer.
Allow me to do
so,
it.
So please, I'll defer to the technical expert here.
Senator Johnson, Chair Manning, members of the committee, ditto.
Okay, cool.
That was a technical Air Force response.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So having covered our presentation on cybersecurity, we'd like to move now to our finance presentation. And Cora Parker, veteran and expert director, talk about banking and cash management. This is one of the most immediate kind of day-to-day activities that we engage in, probably the highest level of engagement with our state agencies and universities and local government customers. So Cora's got a lot to tell us about her team's work on cash management and modernization efforts. Please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee. My name is Cora Parker. I'm the director of the finance division for the Oregon State Treasury. In that regard, I'm responsible for cash management, which includes banking activities, and then the collateralization pool that the Deputy State Treasurer mentioned earlier. So today we're going to talk primarily about cash management. So to start with answering the question of just what is cash management, generally it's a broad area of finance that involves the collection, handling, and usage of cash on behalf of entities. It includes some kind of account administration, the collection and disbursement of funds, so those are the transactional activities, and then reporting, both transaction reporting and balance reporting. Think the bank statements that your bank, your commercial bank, provides to you. And then, of course, the short-term investment of those funds as well. So the treasurer, by statute, is the sole banking and cash management officer for the state of Oregon. In that role, we provide agencies, public universities, and local governments a variety of services that fall under that realm. Importantly, we invest the Oregon Short-Term Fund, which also includes local government investment pool monies. And you heard my colleagues speak quite specifically about some of those actions earlier. While the balance fluctuates over time, it was approximately $16 billion at the end of April. We also maintain and report a variety of account balance information, both for our local government and for our state agency and public university customers. And we support and facilitate the deposits and withdrawals into the fund on behalf of local governments. For state agencies and public universities, we also provide a variety of banking and transactional support activities. So depository activities, check and warrant redemption, electronic payment services, which includes wire transfers, ACH or electronic funds transfer activities, and a variety of other services similar to what you may receive through your personal banking relationships as well. We supported more than 14 million of those transactions in calendar year 2016 for a total of $230 billion in funds flowing in and out of the fund.
Ms. Parker, forgive the ignorance of this question, but I need your help. I am told that with liquor and lottery, given that those are considered or characterized as different kinds of money, that is the public nature of that money, that they perhaps have to be banked differently. And I don't know, A, if that's the case, and B, how easy it is for small places who may not have, for example, a U.S. bank branch there, and that's sort of the bank of record, not sort of, that is the bank of record for us, but how you handle cash deposits from those functions of state government, and if, in fact, there is a same-day requirement, and how burdensome that is on the merchants.
Sure. Senator Johnson, Co-Chair Manning, and members of the committee, you've actually touched on a number of issues in the comments you just made, but they all really go back to a variety of what's called public funds law requirements. So Chapter 295 and a variety of individual statutes in Chapter 293 require state agencies and local governments to participate in a variety of public funds protections. And those requirements really are aimed at making sure that public funds, those that are managed and or held on behalf of government officials, are protected both from loss by financial institutions and by loss from the contractors that they may otherwise be engaged in a contractual relationship with. Depending on the specific nature of those funds, there are a variety of mechanisms that are impacted at any given point in time. So, for example, you mentioned the same day requirement. ORS 293-265 requires that state agencies deposit their funds essentially into a state treasury account within one day. There are a number of exceptions to that as well. And in fact, this session, we came forward and suggested some revisions to that that really sort of came to current day banking practices and acknowledged that some updates were necessary to that statute, particularly to extend some of those exemptions and exceptions to our third-party vendor relationships, which had not previously been done. That very directly impacts entities like the Liquor Control Commission, Parks and Rec, a number of others who deliver their services through relationships with third-party vendors. Chapter 295 has been in place for a long time. In fact, many of the provisions were created post-Depression era and really thinking about protecting public funds coming off of what was a very difficult time in this country and where a lot of funds were lost, including for public entities. We have acknowledged that there are some updates that are necessary to that statute to really come into play with modern banking technology and additional contracting provisions that can protect those public funds in different ways. And in fact, we have engaged with the Joint Revenue Committee in suggesting some legislative language that would direct us to create a task force and really study this and come back to the next full legislative session with suggestions for bringing that chapter up to date. So our hope is that we'll be able to do that during the upcoming interim and really come forward to you with some suggestions that help make help make practical delivery of services for our partners like Lottery and others in line with what some of our financial technology companies can provide, but still protect public funds in a way that makes sense for the people of Oregon.
Thank you for a very comprehensive answer.
Okay. So a variety of approaches to public sector banking are found across the states. The slide that you have in front of you right now really shows what a relationship would look like in a state that didn't have a centralized banking mechanism such as the Oregon State Treasurer's Office. You would see that there's relationships with individual financial institutions or depositories would be with a variety of state agencies. So it would be a many-to-many relationship approach. That would mean that not only would we have to have multiple contractual relationships, the vetting and procurement processes would have to, again, be sort of multiplied across the entities. As they negotiated contracts, they wouldn't necessarily have the volume pricing capability that a single entity may have in bringing an additional volume. Again, think back to the $230 billion per year that we talked about. And a variety of other things that would be very difficult in this kind of relationship. Not to mention, even just from a financial reporting perspective and having to work with entities like the Department of Administrative Services as they reported things, having to go to multiple bank accounts and multiple depositories, it's challenging in states that have this kind of approach. In Oregon, we provide a centralized role. So Treasury sits at the center. It allows us to have a one-to-many relationship approach. We're able in that venue to bring significant dollar savings to the table with respect to volume pricing. And more importantly, it allows for that rapid deployment of funds into the Oregon Short-Term Fund. And again, you heard my colleague talk about the rate that we're paying on those funds right now, and being able to get those into that fund quickly is of great benefit to not only state agencies, but to local governments who happen to participate in the pool. So how do we do this? So what you have in front of you is what it's a very cleaned up version of what we sort of lovingly refer to internally as the ugly chart. And for those of you who sit on the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology, I probably blew the name for that, but you've seen this before. And those of you who sat in this committee have seen last session have seen this as well. So it is really a comprehensive set of relationships with vendors and state agencies, as well as an underlying set of systems, including some purchased, some internally built, that have largely been in place for more than 18 years, some of them for longer than that. A few have been upgraded in incremental ways along the line, but really you've got a set of very outdated infrastructure supporting that $230 billion worth of transactions that we talked about a few minutes ago. They're very highly integrated. They require timing and sensitivity issues, high security demands. Again, you heard my CIO peer speak to the security demands and the challenges that he then has to cover from that perspective, and a variety of other risks with the outdated language and other things that these systems are built in. Just for a quick overview, those things that you see sitting at the center, the Phoenix system is what's called a demand deposit account system. It essentially is the book of record. It is very similar to the account structures that you will see in commercial banks that your own personal accounts are run off of as well. The things that sit around it include those items that support our ACH, again, electronic funds transfer systems, as well as the local government investment pool administration, and then those relationships with the Department of Administrative Services for reporting purposes, and the vendor, the transmission of data back and forth between vendors. So systems that are now nearing 20 years old. When we started to face the demands in front of us in having to replace these, we stepped back and looked at what the future was going to bring and acknowledged that rather than continuing to just put something into place and wait for end of life and sort of have that more crisis-driven need for replacement, that instead we would create a continuous improvement program really for the ongoing review and the ongoing refinement and replacement of these systems. That is the Cash Management Improvement and Renewal Program, or CMRIP, the acronym that we refer to it internally. Really, that effort, again, was to have that ongoing continuous look to make sure that we understood not just wait till the end and it's no longer working, but how do we continue to move forward? And really to balance those innovation opportunities against risk awareness and resource capacity, our own resource capacity, but also our agency and, importantly, our vendor resource capacity, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. Right now, we have four projects that are have been chartered underneath this program. One of them is really focusing on vendor relationships. And that's a non-IT effort. And then we have three information technology efforts that are also chartered and that we'll talk about as well. So we'll talk first about that non-IT effort. As Senator Johnson mentioned, we have had a long-standing single relationship for the bulk of our transactional services. That has served us well over the years from a pricing perspective and from an efficiency perspective, but we've also acknowledged that as technology changes, as a variety of regulatory and policy impacts face us and our financial partners, that their choices and their ability to adapt to those things has as much of an impact on us as our ability to do some of those things internally ourselves. So we took the last year and actually went for an open competitive RFP process in order to identify a second major business partner relationship. We have just completed that effort. In fact, it's just been a few weeks ago that we announced the second major relationship partner. Senator Johnson already acknowledged that U.S. Bank has been our longstanding partner. KeyBank is the bank that will be our, again, sort of co-equal business partner as we move forward. And from a
Senator Johnson.
Replacing U.S. or joining U.S.?
So Senator Johnson, members of the committee, joining them at the table. So again, as we see on the slide now, instead of there being a single partnership, we'll have two major partners. Key is already a depository relationship with us, including there are 12 other relationships. But Key will sit at the table in delivering major services. And they will, importantly, be the ones that are delivering ACH services, so electronic funds transfer services, and wire transfers. U.S. Bank will continue to provide warrant and check redemption services and a variety of other lockbox, merchant card service acceptance, etc. So two major partners.
Follow up.
How do you inoculate against competitive maneuvering, and I don't use that in a pejorative sense, but competitive friction between the two of them? That's one. And two, were you able in your discussions that brought Key on board to harmonize charges? I've sat in this committee for a long time and grumped about the fact that I thought we ought to get lower discount rates and we ought to get better service. Talk a little bit about how you're going to harmonize these two major financial institutions and what savings we expect when you have added another provider in the galaxy of U.S. Bank.
Absolutely. Senator Johnson, members of the committee, you have acknowledged over the years that you thought we needed to go out and take a more competitive look at the market. And, certainly not to give you direct credit for that conversation.
I don't mind.
But it was, you know, your conversation and others certainly were contributors to that. I think you'll find and not be surprised that as you ask the question from a competitive nature, that what's brought to the table both by your current banking partner and those who are competing for that business really are, you know, bring advantages to the state. So it's been a very beneficiary effort. The state of Oregon has been, from an industry perspective, I think viewed as sort of off limits, if you will, over the years. And not that we haven't taken other competitive steps over the years and that we haven't changed some of those underlying relationships, because we certainly have. We've been willing to make those changes where it made sense over the years. And our partner, our current partner has always been able to come to the table and compete with really what others have offered. Again, I think as technology changes in a variety of ways, both for our partners and for ourselves, as our demands change and a variety of other regulatory changes, we've acknowledged that it was time to look elsewhere. I think we have good things in front of us, both from a direct cost savings perspective, but also from the ability to have another, from a business continuity and contingency approach, mitigating risks in a variety of areas, whether it's thinking about banking new kinds of services, staying up with the demands and needs of agencies. I'm pleased for what I think the future will bring in this area.
I applaud you for this move. Thank you.
So we have four policy packages that relate to these CMIRT projects. POP 109, well, actually, I should step back and say all four of them were placeholder packages at the governor's budget phase. So all of them were just a $1 placeholder. This one was for any costs associated with that transition of the new partner, and we're happy to report that from an implementation perspective, we're actually phasing this request out. There are going to be no additional dollars here other than those that I'll talk about in a couple of minutes related to our ACH project. So to talk about our three technology projects, really the best way to do that is to go back and revisit that ugly chart. And this time, rather than looking at things from the perspective of the mix of technologies and either off-the-shelf or internally developed systems, we're focusing on them from the services that they provide. So those items that are in gray are, again, those sort of core banking functions, those things that have the reporting and interface perspectives with our variety of partners. The items in light blue, again, are those ACH or electronic funds transfer technologies. And then those in dark blue are those items that support the withdrawals and deposits into the local government investment pool on behalf of those participants. So the ACH and LGIP projects, again, the business systems renewal projects, and you'll see the acronym BSR on some of the pages coming up. That's just our internal project name. So that's what that stands for. Both of the business cases for these efforts were completed in August of 2014. And again, those of you who sat on this committee previously have heard about these projects and, in fact, supported requests for funds in the last legislative session. They both identified the transform alternative, which really includes moving some of the activities out of direct support in the treasurer's office and more of a partner relationship with a service vendor. We've identified that reduces a number of data security risks, of course, removes us as a single point of failure from a disaster recovery or even just day-to-day business continuity perspective. It allows us really to adapt to regulatory, legal, technology changes on more of an ongoing basis. And for our local government investment pool participants, not only does it address all of those items, but it also brings a functionality improvement in that right now they all use a voice response system for their transactions into and out of the pool. And the improvement is that this will be an online mechanism now, really, again, sort of coming into current technology.
It's Senator?
This is tangential to your presentation, but a curiosity. Is Treasury subject to this new phone system that is currently staggering towards completion?
Senator Johnson, I will take a stab at it, and then my boss can shake his head yes or no from behind me. So my understanding is that we will be impacted by it eventually, but...
Ms. Parker, what's impacted mean?
I believe that the underlying contract relationship will go away for Treasury, but we are not being...
I'm sorry, I don't understand. English separated by a common language. Are they going to force you into this mess?
So I believe that we will ultimately be forced into it, but we will own our own future with respect to what we replace it with. So, yes, the underlying system is going away, but we are not necessarily participating through the Department of Administrative Services replacement efforts. Oh.
May I suggest, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we might clarify that with the Deputy Treasurer a little bit later when he's back up with us.
Okay.
Thank you.
And a question of the professional staff. At this point, I don't know whether the work stoppage has started again, whether they're back up and reinstalling, or are they still at stop work?
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, Senator Johnson, I've passed that note to Paul Siebert, and he's looking into it now, so... We'll follow up with the committee. So,
okay, but just something you said caused me to worry about any kind of telecommunication and the fact that that project has staggered so badly out of the starting blocks was just worrisome.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure, appreciate that. So POP 106 was, again, a placeholder at the governor's budget phase. We are now asking for $1.32 million to complete these efforts. Importantly, the business case for the local government investment pool project is unchanged. It is still moving forward with the same recommendation, and that is the service vendor hybrid approach or transform approach. Originally, we had come forward believing that we would use our current Treasury Management Services provider, thinking that that from a timing perspective and from a cost perspective would be most beneficial. As we got into the deep business requirements, we came to understand that the level of customization that would be necessary for a banking institution to support this effort really was cost prohibitive and did not make sense as we moved forward. So we stepped back, we put a hold on that project, we went out and did a significant amount of due diligence. We found out that really there was a broad set of potential vendors who would support this in an off-the-shelf manner that did not require that level of customization. We did a full-scale competitive RFP, and in the fall we selected one of those vendors. We have signed our contract with them and are in the project planning, the later stages of project planning. We have a target date of February of 2018 for final implementation of this effort, and we actually hope to implement significantly sooner than that if we can move forward in a way that hits before October 1 of 2017, which is when many of our pool participants, particularly our major counties, are affected by a significant amount of tax dollars coming in and out and being transferred among pool accounts. If we can target before 10-1, then we'll actually do that and be able to show, an early implementation. We'll continue to work with QAQC vendor and the Legislative Fiscal Office as we move forward. This committee placed some requirements with respect to project readiness assessment last session, and we will continue to work through that effort with the Legislative Fiscal Office as we complete this project this biennium. Again, I also mentioned that there was approximately $2 million of customization or implementation dollars that were in the last budget approval, and those went unspent this biennium and would also, this request before you constitutes the full request and really represents less in terms of implementation dollars and more just the ongoing cost of the systems itself. POP 107, which is our ACH, or Electronic Funds Transfer Project. Again, the underlying business case foundation is still in place. Again, we had originally anticipated moving forward with our current Treasury Management Services provider. Due to a number of risks, similar to those that I talked about in continuing to just have a single relationship, we decided to award this project to that new business partner that we brought forward. So rather than our prior business partner, U.S. Bank, bringing us this project forward, we'll use KeyBank as our ACH implementation partner. The costs that you see here in front of you, the $600,000, are for ongoing costs of the program, the implementation dollars, really there is no additional implementation charge from KeyBank as they come forward. And again, we'll continue to work with the Legislative Fiscal Office, use a QAQC provider, and go through the readiness assessment in the same way that we would have as we produce the project for you last session. And then finally, POP 108, that's our core banking project. Again, all of those systems that sort of sit at the heart of our banking infrastructure. We had anticipated that we would complete a business case and have an implementation project ready for you this session. As you might imagine, stepping back on our two other project efforts, running two full-scale RFPs, really forced us to take a pause on this one. We had already asked for mitigation dollars for a variety of internal mitigation approaches this current biennium. And we have asked for some additional funds from a mitigation perspective for next biennium, and now anticipate completing that business case and bringing forward an implementation project prior to the next legislative session. And that is the end.
Thank you, Ms. Parker. So we're going to make a quick transition here, and I want to talk briefly about governance. The deputy is joining me again here, and I'm glad he is because it gives me a chance to talk about something that you might not know just by looking at him. He is among our most tenured team members, and frankly, this worries me in the following sense. He has 13 direct reports and a very long tenure. Much as we might like to deny it, his eventual retirement is approaching. So when I was sworn in, I began asking about the possibility of a chief operating officer, both as a resilience effort and a chance to unload some of the burden that the deputy treasurer now carries, and also to begin preparing for that eventual retirement. So that is part of POP 201, which we'll summarize in a minute. It has two other elements, and I'll let Mr. Bond talk about the impact of a budget officer on our capacity for a moment.
Treasury doesn't have dedicated budget resources. We never have. I think John, probably better than anybody, can attest to the need that we have to better be able to respond to the needs of LFO, to be able to more directly respond to the needs of the committee, to better resource our budget development and our budget monitoring and maintenance efforts. And that's what it is, adding resource to our back office to better to have some direct budget, dedicated budget resources.
We've done our best to date, and Cora and Byron particularly deserve a lot of credit for coordinating our efforts, but we think this will add to our capacity. The other thing I wanted to talk about, Mr. Shervin already mentioned the concept of having a dedicated investment officer when it comes to ESG. This is an acronym in the investment world known as Environment, Social, and Governance. And what we really feel like is that we're not including that and integrating those considerations to the extent we should when we make decisions about our investment strategies. They really represent another risk factor, and I could talk for a long time about that. But this adds, I think, to our capacity to make good decisions as we identify strategies and pursue them. So that's the part of those three positions are part of POP 201. And they're clear there, and we'll continue to work on technical adjustments with LFO. You can see all of the things we've talked about so far rolled up here, and I won't spend too much time on that slide unless we need to. This, Mr. Chair, is where our best guess was as to where we might end up at about 4:30, and it appears that we're pretty close. We're happy to plow ahead if you'd like, or stop here and pick it up tomorrow.
Why don't we do that? We'll stop here tonight for the day, and we'll pick it up tomorrow. So far, it's very impressive. I like the way you're going through your presentation. I'm learning quite a bit about Treasury. At this level, so it's really great information for me as I'm in my first term here. And hopefully we'll get to have some more questions for you tomorrow. So, Mr. Treasurer, at this time, what we'll do is that we're going to adjourn the meeting for today, and we'll reconvene again tomorrow for at 1500 hours, which is 3 o'clock civilian time. Are there any questions from the committee? No questions. We will adjourn and see you tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll adjourn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll adjourn and see you tomorrow. Thank you.